Thank you very much. And so, really grateful to, again to be back. And it's amazing to see PI again. I'm happy to say that I'm still able to get lost in this building. So, you know, it feels like no time has passed whatsoever. And thanks a lot for coming, despite the title of my talk. Oh, hey, that didn't do what I thought it did. Okay. Oh, no, it did do what I... Oh, that's how the laser pointer works. Sorry. Any case, thanks a lot for coming, despite the title of the talk. Because the title sounds really stupid. Because, like, what I'm trying to tell you in this particular talk is that we can use quantum computers in order to be able to simulate systems of harmonic oscillators. Now, for those of you who come from a physics background, this sounds like the dumbest thing in the world, I think, coming into it directly. And in fact, many people on SciRate would agree with you. But it's actually more interesting than you might think, because ordinarily, if you think about harmonic oscillators, you'd say, come on, what's so hard about it? There's an analytic solution. To simulate a harmonic oscillator. Why would we want to build a quantum computer for this? Furthermore, you know, there's efficient algorithms that we can end up running in order to simulate this. So why bother? Well, what we want to be able to do is we want to be able, in this work, to show that we can actually build a quantum algorithm for simulating systems of exponentially many coupled classical harmonic oscillators. And we show a quantum algorithm that's capable of achieving this. So imagine you have like 2 to the n interacting springs. And those 2 to the n interacting springs will have some, you know, maybe sparse couplings with each other in order to make the problem tractable. And we show that a quantum computer can simulate it. Now, that is really kind of neat in and of itself, because exponential speedups are actually pretty rare in quantum computing. But the thing that's even cooler about it is that in the past, there have been a lot of claimed exponential speedups for various tasks. And unfortunately, many of them have actually fallen on their face. This is one of those rare examples where we are able to provide some complexity theoretic guarantees that it's very unlikely that our algorithm can be dequantized, because we show that we can actually get an arbitrary quantum calculation and think about it as a very and simulate it using a very specific set of settings for the masses and springs for a exponentially large system of oscillators. And this means that unless BPP equals BQP, there's no way that our algorithm can be dequantized. And also, at a high level, the thing that I really like about this is that it ends up saying, in some sense, that there isn't actually any additional computational power that we end up getting from having genuine quantum interference that we don't get from having mechanical interference. So from this perspective, actually, we can end up seeing that, yeah, we can take this entirely classical system on many, many degrees of freedom and simulate the effects of quantum interference using only mechanical wave interference. So that's kind of, you know, the interesting part about it from a foundational perspective. But I'll take you through it, and actually the idea behind it, the work is really stupid and really easy. Now, the next thing that I'd like to bring up, it's actually kind of a smallish group of people here. If anybody wants to interrupt me or ask any questions at any point during the talk, please do so. I want this to be as interactive as possible, and I want ideally all of you to be able to come out of this talk, at least having learned one thing. Okay? So please, stop me at any time. So, high level, the question is, what does the landscape of exponential speedups end up looking like? And this is not intended to be a complete description of all of the speedups that we know we can end up getting in quantum computing. But I wanted to give you kind of like a very, very rough lay of the land of what things end up looking like for the quantum speedups that are exponential, that we have some good reason to suspect are an exponential speedup. Okay? Now, there's a couple of them. The first one, and the most obvious one, is obviously quantum simulation. That was Feynman's original motivation for building a quantum computer in the first place, because obviously the dimension of the Hilbert space that we end up looking at for solving a Schrodinger equation is exponentially large, so a direct approach to simulating a Schrodinger equation falls on its face. And also path integral methods end up, unfortunately, typically suffering from sign problems that prevent us from actually simulating quantum dynamics that way, using a polynomial amount of space. So simulation, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on the subfield you're in of computer science, ends up being something that's very difficult, but quantum computers can do it actually in polynomial time. Similarly, actually, these ideas from this were used, and then actually the ideas were subsequently then taken out of, linear systems algorithms, which were originally developed by Harrow, Hassenden, and Lloyd in 2009 or so. And the basic idea behind all of these is that they were able to show that you could solve problems involving matrix inversion on a quantum computer by borrowing ideas from simulation in polynomial time. And furthermore, if you could do so using a classical computer, i.e. if you could simulate their algorithm using an ordinary computer, you could actually implement an arbitrary quantum calculation on a classical computer. So in that case, we strongly suspect for linear systems that they actually do provide a exponential speedup. And similarly, differential equations ended up coming out as a natural extension of these ideas, because by inverting a differential operator that you end up expressing in this form, what you can do is you can solve the solution for an arbitrary linear differential equation just by using the same ideas in linear systems. And so we've ended up coming up with that. And lately, there's been a lot of work looking at the nonlinear case, which involves actually a linearization of the nonlinear differential equation. But that is one of the big sorts of areas. There's other, of course, things that are interesting about it that I won't go into in detail. But again, the challenge with all of this is, how do we find new classes of these types of problems that do offer exponential speedups? And we suspect that it's going to be unlikely that a smart computer scientist will be able to come up with a good randomized algorithm in order to be able to simulate. Okay? So, i.e., I want to defend myself against the Yuan Tangs of this world. All right? And so that is one of the big tasks that we would like to do. Now, for this work, actually, this work started out because of some conversations stretching back actually into the before time, you know, before COVID and everything, where these linear system algorithms had come out and promised exponential speedups. But the question is, okay, great, you've got an exponential speedup. What are we actually going to try to get an exponential speedup for? Because what we really need in order to be able to do this is we need to find problems that naturally end up arising that have a huge dimensional vector space to be able to deal with. And also, furthermore, are likely to end up resisting randomization. So let me show you one example that ends up coming up quite naturally. And that's the simulation of classical dynamics in general. So this problem that I'm discussing up here is actually a superset of the one that I'm going to be talking about later. So you could use this in order to be able to simulate classical dynamics in general, and actually even nonlinear differential equations can be rephrased in this form and solved as a linear differential equation. So the idea basically behind this approach is that what we would like to do is we'd like to be able to simulate the dynamics not of a trajectory, but of a probability distribution on those trajectories. The dynamics of that is given by the Liouville equation, which I wrote down there involving a Poisson bracket. So it's a first-order system of differential equations that you can end up expressing. That depends on the commutator of the density and the classical, not the commutator, sorry, the Poisson bracket of the commutator, or sorry, too much time in quantum, clearly, of the density operator and the Hamiltonian, not operator, but Hamiltonian-like function. So the basic idea behind this is that we can actually represent pretty much all of classical dynamics this way. And the advantage or the challenge about doing this on a classical computer is the fact that the dimension that we end up taking a look at of our probability density is enormous. Specifically, like if you just imagine how this ends up going, it goes the same way that quantum goes. Every time we put a new degree of freedom in our system, now we have like square, or you know, we'll have an extra copy of the number of possibilities. So for example, imagine I had a discrete distribution over just like 10 positions. Classically, if I had a one-dimensional problem, there'd be 10 possibilities that I'd have to keep track of in my probability distribution. If I had two such degrees of freedom, now I'd have 10 by 10, because I'd have to specify both of those degrees of freedom, and it'd be 100. If I had three, it'd be 1,000. Four, it would be 10,000. And five, well, you get the idea. Moral of the story is that the dimension of the description of the probability distribution that we end up seeing scales exponentially with the number of particles that we're looking at, which sucks. Okay, but a quantum computer using this can actually simulate this in polynomial time. Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like there's this next slide. So it sounds like, at first glance, this suggests that that quantum computers could actually get, with differential equations, speed-ups over a large number of classical problems. But the truth is they can't, because of this exact same reason that Dave mentioned, that it's actually possible to simulate this probability density just by taking individual trajectories from this and solving, say, Newton's equations of motion for each of these. And then you sample from the resulting distribution, and life is good. And we can end up actually getting an algorithm that can do this in time that's now polynomial in the number of particles and inverse polynomial in the error tolerance that we're looking for. And the reason why it's not polylogarithmic is because in the event that you've got chaos, you really have to spend exponential precision, and that can lead to 1 over epsilon. So in any case, cool. All right. So the question is, you know, based on this sampling argument, this raises a question about whether or not differential equations can be dequantized easily. And in the case of the Liouville equation, you totally can dequantize it. So the question is, does there exist classes of differential equations that we strongly suspect cannot be dequantized? And the great news, as this meme-filled slide is suggesting, is that, yeah, there actually are differential equations that we strongly suspect cannot be dequantized. Can anybody give me an example? Come on, there's participation marks here. All right. Schrodinger equation is the default answer. So we spent a while thinking about this, and that was literally the only case that we could come up with of a good differential equation that we could get an exponential speed up for. The reason why that the Schrodinger equation has this property is basically when we end up taking a look at the classical, the kind of a trajectory-based version of it, we run into the sine problem to try to deal with it. So in some sense, it's negativity and the presence of interference that we end up getting in the solutions that end up actually making the Schrodinger equation difficult to dequantize using these randomized methods. Okay? And so every time that we looked at this, we're like, gosh, is this an isolated point? Are quantum equations of motion the only thing, differential equations, that a quantum computer could provide an advantage for? And so just to give you an idea about, you know, how you might try to dequantize this, you would end up using techniques actually that are really kind of popular for many of the folks in this building. Because a standard way that you would think about dequantizing this is to go to a path integral method. So what you would end up doing in this particular case is you would say, okay, effectively, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my time evolution operator, I'd say trotterize it, and then represent the trotterized operator in the eigenbasis of each of the terms that you've got at each of the times. When you expand that product out, you end up getting something that can be interpreted as a sum over all the paths that you're going through with phases that depend on the particular eigenvalues that each of those paths transitions through. And then the final amplitude that you end up getting will be the sum of the amplitudes from all the paths that go from point A to point B. Cool. The biggest difference between this and the classical case is all of those paths are now weighted by the phase that they pick up on each of them. And we know that the resulting distribution has to be normalized, but actually each of the individual paths that we're putting through have basically the same normalization condition. So there's a huge amount of cancellation that ends up happening in the resulting distribution in the end. And this causes the variance that you end up getting for an estimate of any of these probabilities to be exponentially large, which is the origin of the fermion, origin of the sign problem. And so that's why this ends up failing. Yeah.
Even if you have the sign problem, I mean, that doesn't mean that the dequantization works in a sense. Like, for example, for Euclidean time evolution with a stochastic Hamiltonian, you would have no sign problem, but you can't guarantee a polynomial time runtime like what you wrote on the previous slide.
Totally. So what I guess what I'm getting at is I want to give some intuition about why standard dequantization strategies fail when we try to take a look at the Schrodinger equation. Of course, at some level, we don't know whether or not the Schrodinger equation can be dequantized because we don't know whether BPP equals BQP. I mean, everybody in their right mind, except Gil Kalai, maybe, thinks that they're distinct, but we kind of don't know at some level, right? And I just really wanted to give an idea about why we could dequantize one, but we can't dequantize the other using these techniques. Potentially using other techniques, we could. And the point of this work, or the point of the project that we got into at this point, was to try to see if we could come up with some great example of a problem that is not the Schrodinger equation, but yet still has enough interference in some sense to make it so that we couldn't likely apply some statistical sampling or some type of approach to dequantize it. And in the end, it worked out far better than we thought because we could prove this reduction. Okay, any other questions before I continue? Cool, okay. And yeah, it's basically the thing that we're looking for is interference and or contextuality, but I don't see any foundations nerds here, so I can ignore the term contextuality. If you don't know what it is, these are not the droids you're looking for. So, partially this question or inspiration for where to look, why we chose to look at harmonic oscillators is because of this old paper that I randomly stumbled into ages ago. And for those of you who haven't seen it, I think this paper is actually fascinating. It's an ancient paper by Grover, you know, of Grover search fame. And the paper really was taking a look at the system of coupled pendulum. And the idea basically is that Grover ended up showing that the mathematics of the system of coupled oscillators is actually equivalent to the mathematics that you end up seeing for Grover search. And by encoding this 1 in n Grover search problem in order as a problem where you want to be able to infer from the response of the pendulum to different driving frequencies, which of the masses that is the one that corresponds to the shorter string, he showed that you could do this in square root n time, just classically. So in some sense, this really kind of, I thought, was interesting because at a high level, I'd always thought, and in some sense it still is true, that the advantages that you end up seeing from Grover's search kind of end up showing a difference between quantum and classical. But here, we've got this classical model that actually can solve Grover's search in square root n time. Now, admittedly, it's an analog model, and it has many of the same issues that analog models of computing have. And I don't want to go into those, but if people want to bug me later, there's a lot of reasons why engineering this particular device is impractical. But from a conceptual point of view, it's suggesting that there's actually kind of deeper mathematical links between systems of oscillators and quantum than we might have thought at first glance. So when me and the rest of the Avengers who did this, just going back, so this team over here is pretty much like, it's pretty close to like the Avengers team from that perspective, right? Because it was amazing to have all of these people sitting down, working together in Australia for like a month solid on a single problem. And we had that opportunity. Okay, maybe it wasn't a month, maybe it was a week, but it felt like a month. This is what we ended up doing. We ended up saying, okay, well, let's take this problem and see if we can transfer it over and ask maybe exponentially large systems of coupled harmonic oscillators could be this example that we've been looking for all along. Maybe these systems have enough mechanical interference to end up making it so that it's unlikely that we can dequantize it. So here's the problem that we end up having. The problem for the coupled harmonic oscillators is the following. Let's assume that we've got a system of 2 to the n coupled harmonic oscillators such that the energy function is this quadratic form at the top. Now, I emphasize quadratic because this part is actually ultimately the main reason that we end up seeing such a nice algorithm for it. It's because of the fact that the energy is quadratic, and we'll get back to that. So, in any case, the classical dynamics that we end up seeing from this, then, is just essentially given by the following first-order system of equations that you all know and love from your second-year mechanics courses. Okay? Now, this, if we end up taking a look at what the solution ends up looking like after rescaling the units for position and momentum accordingly, what we end up getting through this wonderful animated GIF that the internet was able to provide me royalty-free is, I hope it's royalty-free at least, is we end up seeing that the position and velocity for this particle end up actually circling around beautifully like that, okay? That was the big hint that allowed us to crack this problem. And the reason why this is a big hint is because as soon as we started thinking about it, we're like, gosh, that looks like something that we all know and love. It looks like precession of a Bloch vector. Right? So we can think about the dynamics that we end up seeing in this this case where the dynamics is constrained to move in the circle is exactly the same as like in a qubit going through an RY rotation. So then this there's a number of early algorithms we had that literally ended up reducing this problem to a simulation of the 2D case like this. But in any case, what we want to do is we want to take advantage of this. And the way our algorithm works is basically what we want to do is we want to come up with an encoding so that we can take advantage of the fact that due to energy conservation in some coordinate system, the particle the system of coupled oscillators ends up moving around in a perfect circle of constant norm. And we want to turn that motion of constant norm into basically a unitary dynamics. Then, once we translated it to unitary dynamics, then we just want to build a quantum circuit to end up implementing it, okay? So that's the intuition behind this. Now, the particular encoding that we finalize, and actually we talk about a couple of different encodings in the paper, but the slickest one that we take a look at is the following. And this is kind of, at first glance, this is a pretty weird encoding that we do. So what we do is we take each of the individual particles and represent each of their momenta as part of the wave function that we're using to describe the system. And then what we do is we take each of the displacements and represent the displacements down below. Now you imagine the natural thing and the first thing that I wanted to try to do when I attacked this problem was to split this up into the momenta and the individual positions for this. And we could get that to work, but there were some problems about condition numbers and stuff that came up with it. But this approach over here, and you'll notice redundant. We have n squared, or order n squared, pairs of distances between the particles down in the bottom part of it, but only order n, or 2 to the n, I guess, in this notation, momenta up above. So we're keeping track of a redundant number of positions. And you might ask, well, why the heck are you doing that? Well, the reason why we're doing that is is all because of the energy. So when we take a look at the energy, right, the energy, as I said before, is quadratic. So when we plug this representation in and compute the norm of this vector, we see up to a scaling, which depends on the initial energy of the system, that actually this vector is going to be the same length for all possible configurations that have the same energy. So if we're looking at closed system dynamics within this representation, conservation of energy corresponds to conservation of the length of this vector for the harmonic oscillator. Okay? And that's the idea, because what we want to do is we want to capture this intuition. We want to make it so that the motion of the particle ends up corresponding to a length-preserving rotation in its quantum analog. And we want to do basically this, but construct an analog that works for higher dimensions. And that's what this encoding ends up doing. Okay? So it's a little redundant, but it satisfies precisely that same intuition that was present on the previous picture. Okay? So that's the idea. Now, in order to be able to show that that just strictly shows length preservation, but it doesn't necessarily end up guaranteeing that the dynamics, classical dynamics of the system in this particular representation will correspond to unitary evolution. I mean, we feel in our guts it would, right? But kind of, you know, if we put our mathematicians' hats on, we still do technically have to show that it's a unitary transformation. And so this can be seen through a number of steps. And the steps involve taking a look at the following. First, let's take a look at the differential equation and write it first as a second order ODE. We can take the masses and represent the masses by a mass matrix, capital M, and we can end up taking then the quadratic term over here, or I guess linear once you've differentiated it for the force, and now write that as just a force matrix multiplied by all the positions that are coming in that we stored here. So then our differential equation in x can then be represented in this particular form over here. Now, what we do is we would like to come up with these rescaled coordinates that we end up calling y. And once we've rescaled the coordinates by the masses in order to get something closer to what we have in the end, then what we end up needing is this extra operator A, which is sort of a mass rescaled version of the force. Because we've rescaled the position, we need to now rescale the definition of force in order to be able to deal with it. Now, once we've done this, the second derivative of this y coordinate becomes really nice. It looks just like y double dot equals negative a y for this operator. What we can now do is we'd like to be able to show this as something that looks just like the Schrodinger equation. So we add and subtract this term that look, or, well, I guess we add to both sides of the equation this term that goes like a or I square root a y dot. When we factor this out, we end up seeing now in this coordinate system, y dot plus I square root a blah, 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 that we end up getting unitary dynamics. And this ends up corresponding to the coordinate system that we ended up picking previously, or the encoding that we ended up picking previously. So this ends up showing that when we end up switching to this different representation for the positions, that the dynamics is literally unitary in this, and thus it satisfies this intuition that we want here, to take the classical dynamics and transform it into an equivalent unitary dynamic, set of unitary dynamics. So everything then, once we've done this, boils down to simulating square root A, okay? Where A is related to, it's basically like the force operator that we end up needing. So we can get all the information from A via a quantum oracle that ends up providing us the coupling strengths between any two oscillators in the problem and tells you, for example, which oscillators a particular one is coupled to. So using very similar techniques to what we end up getting from Hamiltonian simulation, because this now is basically just a Hamiltonian simulation problem. Okay, cool. So now, how are we going to go about this? So our first and simplest algorithm for this is what I like calling the OGHHL method, okay? And the idea behind this method is really what we'd like to do is we'd like to figure out what square root A is. Big problem, we don't know what square root A is, right? We only have access to the matrix elements of A. But in this representation, we need the square root of this exponentially large operator. So how are we gonna do this? Well, easiest way to do this is to use quantum phase estimation. So if we coherently use quantum phase estimation to store the eigenvalues of this positive semi-definite matrix A in the quantum system, then what we can do is we can use that to simulate the dynamics. And so for those of you who haven't seen this before, let me take you through the steps of what this looks like. For those of you who have seen it before, you can check your email because this is pretty much exactly the same reasoning that HHL ended up using. So the basic idea is that what we want to do is we want to prepare our initial state, which corresponds to the initial positions, or the initial displacements that we're seeing, and the initial momenta of the system. And we assume that we know what the initial energy is for this, so that way we can interpret the normalization constant properly for this state. So we prepare the state, and then what we do is we begin by simulating the dynamics not of square root A, but we simulate the dynamics of AT and apply that in a phase estimation circuit for a value of T that's less than or equal to this over here. And the reason why we need to have a short T is because if the eigenphases wrap around the unit circle, we won't be able to work back and figure out what they were. So we just, it doesn't matter what time we pick for the evolution to try to learn the eigenvalues of A, we just need to pick something that doesn't cause the eigenvalues to wrap around and become greater than 2 pi, so we can correctly invert it, okay? So that's the first step. And then, basically, what we do is once we end up getting those values stored as a qubit string from phase estimation, and by the way, I've ignored details like error probability as well as the errors that we end up seeing in the estimate that we comes out the other side. What we then do is we then build a reversible circuit for the square root operation. So we take those bits and we run it through just like a classical series of multipliers in order to be able to approximate the square root. Now we have the square root over here. We can then simulate e to the negative I square root A by taking these values over here and doing a series of controlled rotations based on those bits that we have in order to implement this phase. Then we just invert all the crap that we ended up doing in the end, and the dynamics is equivalent to the dynamics of e to the i or negative I square root A, which is exactly this expression that we need over here. Okay, so that's how the dynamics ends up working for that. And now if we go through, basically this is just a formal statement of the particular problem. The biggest thing that I want to bring your attention to is what the cost is for it. Now, one of the challenges is the cost ends up really depending on the amount of error that we end up getting in the square root. A challenge that we end up having with the square root is a square root, and for those of you who have worked with this in LCU or QSVT, square root sucks. I mean, it really is a nasty function. The reason why is that the square root function ends up looking kind of like this. And the derivatives become extremely large in some small region about zero. So if we want to be able to closely approximate the square root of the function around here, we actually need a lot of precision in order to be able to get that to work well. And so this problem over here ends up having two different costs depending on the regime that we're in. If we don't know what value of what the value of A inverse is over here, then we could conceivably be inside this regime over here where the derivative is large. In that case, we're going to need to have enough precision in the worst case scenario to be able to learn what that eigenvalue is within error epsilon. And this leads to inferior scaling with T and epsilon. However, if we're outside of that regime over here, then we can do actually a slightly more sophisticated error analysis and show that the scaling is actually better than that. It goes like T. And linear scaling with T is optimal by the no fast forwarding theorem. Yeah, Dave.
So the polynomial in 1 over epsilon scaling, do you have a matching lower bound, or is it possible that it could be improved by a different method?
It's conceivable it could be improved by a different method. Now, I suspect in this particular case that it might be possible to come up with a state discrimination lower bound for values that would be very close to the point where it jumps up. And I suspect that if we could have an algorithm that did this, that we would violate state discrimination lower bounds. But this is not a good argument here. And but one of the things I should say is that for a different problem later, we'll show a method that has exponentially better epsilon scaling because it eschews the use of phase estimation, but has a more specific encoding. Okay. Yeah.
Just notation, what is the max norm and what is d-sparse here?
Okay, great question. So d-sparse over here, what it refers to is the maximum number of non-zero of elements or oscillators that each oscillator can be connected to. Okay, so what we're assuming here is that there's an exponentially large number of oscillators, but each of the oscillators isn't connected to very many. So for example, let me give you like an easy way to visualize this. Imagine what you wanted is you were interested in something like say a 2D network of oscillators, okay? Something like this. Okay, I'm getting bored, I'll stop drawing it. No, I'm getting obsessive, so I'll keep drawing it. Okay, so if we have a case like this, right? Each of these oscillators would correspond to a D equals 4 sparse oscillator because each of them is coupled to 4 neighbors. I guess actually because we allow self-coupling in here, it might be actually a 5 sparse because technically we have another term in a Hamiltonian that will end up giving a force based on its displacement from a fixed wall. So that would basically be your notion of sparsity. The total number of particles in this case could be arbitrarily large. We could have a huge network of them, but we're requiring a very small number of oscillators that each of them go to. And that's the notion of sparsity that we're getting at. Now, the max norm that we're taking a look at here, the max norm is probably the simplest norm that you can think of. It's just the biggest matrix element present in the matrix in the representation that you're taking a look at. So for example, let's say that I had, the matrix 1, 2, 3, 4, right? The max norm of this would be equal to 4, okay? So basically, it's just a notation for saying, figure out the biggest element of your matrix. And we need that because this and the sparsity end up forming kind of a natural scale for the strength of the oscillators. Okay, so that's one way you could think about it. It kind of gives you, your typical kind of like force scale for the problem. Any other questions? Yeah.
So in some cases, you can take like an effective square root of A by going to a larger Hilbert space. Is that something that does not work here? Or?
You can get a square root of
An effective square root, like by introducing additional qubit or something, by going to a larger Hilbert space.
Yeah, so what we can do is, we don't know of any way of potentially improving that at the moment. It could be done. However, using the second encoding, we'll be able to get a square root descaling out of that. Is that what you're kind of referring to?
No, I mean like if you have like an A as like a sum of PSD matrices,
oh.
Then you can just go to a larger Hilbert space, like lift to a larger space, and then take square roots of the individual matrices.
That was actually that was the original method that we ended up using for this next technique that I'm talking about.
Okay. Thanks.
And unsurprisingly, Rolando came up with that idea.
Makes sense.
All right, cool. So this ends up showing that we can end up doing the whole thing in positive time. So the next thing is that we'd like to be able to do a similar sort of idea. And it turns out that this method of phase estimation isn't the only way that we can end up dealing with the problem of taking a square root. One way that we could try to do this is we'd like to be able to build a block encoding of the square root under some assumptions that make the problem easier. And the case that we're going to take a look at, as Anirban kind of alluded to, is a case where now all of our couplings in the entire problem have to be positive. Not just PSD here, but we need actually all of them literally to be positive in this case. And so then the idea basically behind it is that what we'd like to do is we'd like to be able to build a matrix B such that B dagger B is equal to A over here. Now, you'll note here, B doesn't necessarily need to be a square matrix if we're thinking about this most broadly. What we need to do is we just need to make sure that we build a rectangular matrix of some particular form such that B dagger B is equal to A. And then in that sense, B is kind of, if this is true, then this is kind of like equivalent to the square root of A in this larger block sense, okay? And so that's what we would like to do. And we specifically would like to choose that our, amongst all of these particular square roots, we'd like to be able to choose our square root in the following way. For J assumed to be less than or equal to K, we then will have this kind of like tuple over here, which is a larger space that we're taking a look at, that now has these two coordinates, J and K, in it. And what we'll have is we'll say, okay, our rectangular matrix B, acting on J and K as input, will now give us J as output if J equals K, and this difference between it if J is less than K. Okay? So that's the notion of the square root that we end up doing. Now, what we can end up showing is that this operator in this particular form can be block encoded using order log squared 1 over epsilon operations. And that's huge, because previously, for the more generic case that we were looking at before, we needed to use phase estimation, which led to an order 1 over epsilon in the best case scenario, and order 1 over epsilon squared in the worst case scenario for it. But this will require order a log squared 1 over epsilon. And the way that we end up doing this is by borrowing ideas from quantum simulation. Basically, what we do is we begin by preparing a uniform superposition over a bunch of ancillas. And then what we do is we do this inequality testing idea that was developed in for chemistry simulations in Hamiltonian simulation. And the idea behind it is that we check to see whether or not our input x, after some rescaling, is bigger than or equal to the square root that we want to generate, which is equivalent to saying, like, imagine if we wanted to say x is less than or equal to square root y. This is equivalent to asking, well, is x squared less than or equal to y? And so by squaring this over here, we can determine whether or not a particular element is less than the probability. Then, by doing a series of swaps on our system, we can actually rejig our probabilities in such a way so that the resulting amplitudes that we get when we multiply through by the rectangular matrix that do the sum over all the particular values will actually end up giving us the quantities that we end up needing. And so this ends up giving us the right result. The only for these square roots, the biggest thing is figuring out how to do the J minus K. That can be done pretty straightforwardly using a Hadamard and a Z-gate then and yet. So these are the steps that we end up involving to get this. And now the question is, well, where does the order log squared 1 over epsilon come from? Well, it comes from just the cost of evaluating the squaring operation. We have to do multiplication, and the multiplication can be done using naive textbook multiplication in quadratically many operations. And so then that is where the log squared 1 over epsilon ends up coming from, effectively. Okay? So that is how the state preparation ends up going for this. Now, in order to turn this into a full simulation algorithm, what we need to do is we now need to define a new effective Hamiltonian that we're dealing with for the particular problem. And what we want to do is we want to be able to simulate, as mentioned previously, this square root of the A matrix over here, which in our context is this B operator now. But because B is not a square matrix here, we can't just simply do e to the negative I B T, because this isn't going to be a Hermitian matrix, because B is going to be a matrix that isn't going to be square, let alone Hermitian. So we need to do something known as a block encoding, where we end up building this as a subblock of a larger Hermitian matrix. Fortunately, there's a standard trick that was originally proposed by Harrow, Hasseldam, and Lloyd. It might have actually been used by people before that, but it came to at least my attention from that paper, where you can say, without loss of generality, every matrix is Hermitian. And the way that this without loss of generality argument works is that we just, if we have an arbitrary B, then we just put B in the top right corner of the matrix and B dagger in the bottom left corner of it. And that resulting matrix that we're taking a look at is now Hermitian in this larger space. So this gives us a way of implementing this B operator. Once we end up doing this dilation, and transforming our coordinates through this B dagger gate or operation down at the bottom, which actually implements, it turns out, the coordinate transformation that we needed in the first place with our representation. Then we end up seeing that this dynamics can all be simulated just by simulating this H operation. And so now we've reduced this problem as well to a standard Hamiltonian simulation problem. So we can go through and simulate the dynamics on this just using an off-the-shelf method. And a method that we choose is cubitization, which ends up having the following scaling over here. It basically ends up scaling like linear in T. With this particular approach, it goes actually like square root of the sparsity, which is cool, because ordinarily, the cost of Hamiltonian simulation goes linearly with the sparsity. Here, it goes like the square root, which is kind of dope. But in any case, it also ends up depending on, you know, the ratio between the strongest spring coupling and the minimum mass. And so basically, like, the stronger your couplings go and the smaller the mass for this approach, the worse this algorithm ends up performing. But in any case, that is the final result. And it's beautiful because it goes in linear time, and the scaling is log 1 over epsilon, which coincides with the best that we could end up getting from the no fast forwarding theorem. Okay, cool. So now comes, like, you know, I realized that I was getting a little too nerdy down the simulation route. So I just want to kind of recap for a sec before I talk about the final a part of this talk, which is, you know, so far what we've shown is we've shown two approaches based on two different encodings that we can end up using that will allow us to simulate in polynomial time a system of exponentially many coupled harmonic oscillators. And there's a bunch of different applications because, you know, for example, like that standard problem that I was talking about, you know, where you've got, say, a bunch of oscillators that are coupled together, you could think of many mechanical systems, like a bridge or part of a car, as a series of coupled springs. In fact, in molecular dynamics, we frequently will also end up thinking about the motion of molecules near equilibrium as a series of coupled oscillators. Basically, a ton of applications in physical sciences as well as engineering boil down precisely to this. So this is really promising, but again, we haven't actually addressed this question about whether or not it can be dequantized. Because if it can be dequantized, well, then at best, we're looking at polynomial speedups for this. Yes?
Sorry to keep interrupting. So the examples that you mentioned, though, those are examples where the oscillators are kind of laid out in space, and, you know, the situation that your algorithm is designed for is a case where you have a sort of effectively 2 to the n oscillators that are somehow encoded in a smaller.
And so let me just be clear about this particular case. My concern is our BQP completeness result doesn't necessarily end up implying that this example is actually computationally hard. I really wouldn't be surprised if this case with relatively weak couplings would be computationally easy, because I imagine you could come up with a light cone argument saying that if you wanted to simulate any local observable around here, you probably wouldn't need to simulate all of the couplings going all the way out to the edge of the system. So I wasn't really trying to say literally this is going to be easy. But the question is this general problem that we're taking a look at. Do there exist hard instances inside this general problem class? And the answer of the next couple of slides will be yes. But an open question still is, well, do there actually exist advantages for engineering applications? And that we don't know yet. But yeah, hopefully that answers your question. Any other questions? Yeah.
This is kind of a higher level question, but like the simulation problem here is you begin with the superposition encoding positions and momenta, and then you end with the time evolved. Like, what do you do with this superposition to get out? What kind of answer are you looking for now that you have that state?
So something like this that you would you'd be interested in is you'd be interested in, say, the energy distribution over the particular modes that you're looking at. So by sampling from it, you would get, you know, randomly one of the indices of a momenta or one of the displacements. And so then by taking a look at the distribution that you end up getting, because the probability is related to the square of that, which is in turn the energy, estimating the partial energy or the contribution to the energy from one of those modes at a given time is our BQP complete problem, it turns out.
Okay, cool.
Awesome. All right, so now let me go through the sketch of the BQP completeness for this. The basic idea is, you know, we showed that simulation of harmonic oscillators is in BQP. In order to show that it's BQP complete, we need to actually also show that it's BQP hard. And a standard way that you end up doing this in TCS is what you do is you assume that you've got a box that just will simulate any system of classical harmonic oscillators. And what we'd like to be able to do is show that there's a way that we can rig this to solve a BQP complete problem. And in particular, our problem is just going to be to apply a series of Hadamards and Toffoli gates. And Hadamards and Toffoli gates form a universal gate set for quantum computing. It's kind of weird because there's no imaginary components here, but trust me, they do actually form a universal gate set. And so we want to carry this this out because it's easy to embed in our oscillators due to the fact that it doesn't have any eyes popping in this view of quantum computing. So if we could simulate an arbitrary sequence of Hadamards and Toffoli gates on an initial zero state, then we'll have effectively been able to simulate an arbitrary quantum computation. So that's the idea behind this. Now, the way that we want to go about this is we want to be able to build the Feynman-Kitaev clock Hamiltonian. And the idea behind it is to build a system whose dynamics will end up actually generating the sequence of gates that we want to apply. For technical reasons, it turns out when you measure it, you'll end up getting this at an arbitrary time during it, but that can be easily dealt with. There's a couple of problems with the direct way of dealing with it. The first is that if we just directly tried to transfer the construction over, we end up getting negative numbers popping in, which for the simulation method that we're using in order to try to deal with this creates a huge problem. The next thing is that we need to worry about the square root of the couplings, not the original one. And that creates some additional problems for the translation. So the basic way that we go about this is that we begin with this A that we want to build. Because this A ends up actually corresponding to the ideal evolution. These WLs here, these correspond to the individual gates that we would like to apply for our system. These over here generate hopping between the individual times that we would have on a time register. So think about separating our space up. So we use part of our oscillators in order to be able to keep track of the time, and the other parts to actually do the quantum computation. This part over here strictly advances the time, and this one over here will pick a series of gates, U1, U2, U3, from the set of Hadamard and Toff in each of them. So we'd like to program each of them in such that the system will fire those particular gates at a given time. Now, the biggest problem that we end up running into this is the fact that Hadamard, unfortunately, ends up having negative components to it, which screws up the simulation method we're using for it. So what we'd like to be able to do is we'd like to be able to come up with a way to get the negative sign in the Hadamard. And the way we do this is by actually extending our system to be a larger system that's entirely positive. So our analog of the Hadamard gate is constructed by adding an extra qubit register onto the side that's used for no other purpose. And then what we do is we say our effective Hadamard is going to be of the form 1 over root 2 IIIX over here. Then we get the X gate to act on a state that's initialized to be minus over here. And that allows us to be able to get negative signs in the dynamics without actually having a negative spring constant in our system, and thus allowing us to reduce to the previous simulation method that I talked about. But that's the only complication that ends up showing up in it. And when we end up doing this, the dynamics of of this object allows us to represent an arbitrary sequence of gates encoded by these WLs, inside our system of oscillators. And thus allows us to construct through a particularly set up system of oscillators, a BQP complete problem. Thus, the simulation problem is BQP hard and in BQP, and therefore it's BQP complete. Okay, so that's how the argument ends up going. So to conclude, this shows that this idea that interference at some level, this kind of confluence of interference and high dimensional vector spaces can in some cases be enough in order to be able to capture, in some sense, the full richness of quantum computing. And when we do this, again, by showing that these systems can be simulated in polynomial time on a quantum computer, and then show that similarly, a system of masses and springs appropriately configured can end up simulating an arbitrary quantum calculation. And with those two pieces put together, that shows that this not only offers an exponential speedup, but one that can't be replicated by a classical computer unless BPP equals BQP, i.e. unless classical computers are just as powerful as quantum computers. So since nobody believes that's true, at least I hope the funding agencies don't, this is strong evidence that this is actually a genuine speedup. But this is actually just kind of the beginning, I think, of these types of questions. One big one is that the dynamics that we ended up looking at was highly specific. It ended up strongly boiling down to this connection that conservation of energy could be mapped into a form that's equivalent to conservation of psi. Okay? But if we have dissipative or time-dependent systems, then energy is no longer a constant of motion. How can we think about dealing with dynamics in this way in order to be able to show that, say, dissipative systems of harmonic oscillators are no more powerful than quantum computers? Or, equivalently, can we come up with good quantum algorithms for simulating that side? And also, because of the thing that we used here is we used this strong relationship between the Hamiltonian being quadratic and the fact that the two norm of the state vector is preserved. Is it possible for us to be able to argue that, you know, if we had a system that, say, had quartic interactions, is it possible under some circumstances to come up with a similar efficient simulation algorithm? Or would equivalent dynamics with quartic interactions be more powerful than quantum computing? We don't know. But perhaps I think the most evocative question, and this is one of the kind of big letdowns about many of the applications in quantum differential equations that motivated this work in the first place, is still this question of, okay, great, we've got a proven exponential speedup, but can we show a useful proven exponential speedup? Can we find problems that are relevant in engineering or physical science that this algorithm would actually give an exponential speedup to? Because if we can find such an example, then conceivably, this new family of algorithms could dramatically increase the range of applicability of quantum computers and make it useful for folks who conceivably have no direct interest in anything related to quantum dynamics. Thank you very much.
Thanks for a great talk. Any questions?
Thank you for the talk. Just a speculative question. I was trained in high energy theory, so when I hear coupled oscillators, I think of a QFT on some lattice or something. Have you thought about trying to use this algorithm to simulate?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that last part.
Have you thought about trying to use this algorithm to simulate some free field theory or something like that?
To simulate what? I'm sorry.
Some free like quantum field theory or something like that.
Oh, we haven't taken a look at that directly. So at present, actually, simulating quantum field theories in general is hella difficult. We've got some preliminary results now in totally unrelated work that give gate count estimates for simulating, say, scalar phi to the fourth theory. And the best results that we have right now for that are 10 to the 12 gates or so. So work is being done in that direction. But I guess the deal is that most of the time, the differential equations are, you know, or at least often in the cases that I've taken a look at, there's a Hamiltonian formulation that we can take advantage of that would allow us to translate it. I think the better question is, can we come up with good ways of simulating path integration on quantum computers? Because that would allow us to really tackle the whole breadth of problems in quantum field theory. But this over here, I don't know if we could end up doing it in some clean way that we couldn't do with traditional Hamiltonian simulation methods.
Yeah, thanks for the talk. I got a little lost on the previous slide. Were you using a physical system of classical oscillators and then time evolving this classically?
Yes, that's basically the idea. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to be able to argue, like when we're taking a look at this over here, we wanted to figure out what these couplings would end up looking like. So we can end up viewing each of these interactions over here as a coupling between two different oscillators that we end up having in this Feynman-Kitaev representation. So what we would like to do is we'd like to say, for every Hamiltonian that we would like to represent, we can come up with, in this representation, a system of masses and springs that ends up coinciding with it. So we're going to choose the system of masses and springs that ends up coinciding with this Hamiltonian that we know can simulate an arbitrary quantum calculation. And then the only trick that ends up coming in is because, at least with this approach over here, we require all the elements be positive. We have to do some shenanigans in order to be able to deal with the fact that we can only encode positive coefficients for the oscillators. And that's what's going on in this last slide, is I'm just saying that by putting a resource state that's the minus state in here, I can get a minus sign by applying x to the minus state. Okay?
Sorry, I'm still not... Like, the resource state here is interacting with the classical oscillators?
Yeah, that's basically it. So this resource state over here is classical, too. Okay, we're just using Dirac notation in order to be able to describe this classical configuration in the exponential space. So the Dirac notation is not implying here that it's quantum. This is really actually, perhaps it was confusing us using Dirac notation for this, but we wanted to make a link to the quantum language this case. But it really is actually just a vector encoding the classical dynamics here.
Any other questions?
So I was just wondering, this gives you an easy way to tell you energy distribution over modes. Is there any straightforward way to get an idea of, like, say, for example, what the lowest frequency is over the entire space?
Mm. Lowest frequency is actually kind of easy, because all you need to do for that is you just need to do phase estimation on the original A operation. Mm-hmm. Now, it's easy to sample from that. Now, figuring out the lowest one on that, in general, that ought to be a QMA hard problem.
So you don't get around that.
Yeah, just because of the fact that this is BQP hard, and so then finding the lowest energy version of that ought to be QMA hard.
Got it, thank you.
No problem. Jack had a question.
Yeah, so you mentioned as like a possible extension of this work, trying to understand if it's possible to simulate, you know, systems that have like a quartic potential, for instance. I'm just kind of wondering, do you think like more generally it might be possible to come up with other mappings between like, you know, the unitarity condition and quantum computation and like other kinds of physical conservation laws? Because, you know, there are a lot of other conservation like laws, you know, in classical mechanics other than necessarily like just conservation of like energy in the most simple sense.
Exactly. So what we really want to do is we would like to be able to kind of at a high level understand the generalization of this. And the generalization, I think, is something kind of on the lines of we'd like to be able to change a representation of the dynamics so it ends up looking symplectic. Mm. And then if we can find a way of making it so that it's symplectic, then the next step is to making it look unitary. And then once we've done that, then we're home free. And that's kind of the pattern that we ended up doing over here. And the question is, what's the ultimate range of problems where that program will be successful? And that is open.
Sounds like a fun mathematical problem.
Good thing for you to get distracted by, yes. You can toss it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So if I understand correctly, you need to get access to the K matrix, which gives you the coupling constant.
Yeah.
So if I give you a K, how do you build the circuit to realize it?
Like, how do you construct those K?
Yeah, like how do you actually build the quantum circuit to realize this K?
Okay, it's easy. You just use an oracle.
No,
sorry,
I mean,
that joke is funnier for computer scientists. But no, this is an open question too, right? Because we don't talk about what the we don't white box that problem. And this actually, I think, goes to this question of what the application is, because in order for us to talk in more detail about how we would end up filling in those coupling strengths, we have to think about a concrete example that we would like to do. And in some cases, if we were loading all of that information in from some unstructured database, the amount of computational time that we would need to do that would obviously be linear in the number of oscillators, which is exponential, and it would kill us. So
that's right.
In order for us to find a good example where the cost of implementing these quantum oracles with underlie our cost is low, we need to take a look at a problem that's big and yet has to be algorithmically specifiable. And this, again, is one of the challenges that people have ended up facing implementing the HHL algorithm or finding a good application for it, is just dealing with this information kind of bottleneck of moving stuff in. And yeah, nobody knows the answer yet because this result is still fresh. But I'm hopeful, or I'm interested at the very least to see whether or not it actually might be easier to do this than it's proven for HHL.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.
Okay, thank you very much.